This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
It's my pleasure to welcome John Tamney to the show. He is director for the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, a senior economic advisor at Theodore Research and Trading, and editor of Real Clear Markets, best-selling author of Popular Economics, What the Rolling Stones, Downton Abbey, and LeBron James Can Teach You About Economics, and also Who Needs the Fed? What Taylor Swift, Uber, and Robots Tell Us About Money, Credit, and Why We Should Abolish America's Central Bank. But his new book is entitled The End of Work, Why Robots Won't Take Your Job and Might Get You One You Love. We got a lot to talk about today. John, welcome. How are you?
I'm great, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's good to have you. These are great topics. And let's talk a little bit about, what Taylor Swift, Uber, and robots can tell us about money, credit, and why we should get rid of the Fed. Make the connection for us.
Yeah. Well, it's a surprisingly easy connection. Several years ago, my wife and her friends went to a Taylor Swift concert in Washington, D.C. at National Stadium. Afterward, as you can imagine, there was a rush to the exits to get home. And so if you wanted to ride the metro from that stadium, it was going to take at least 2 hours to get on one. Cabs were non-existent, and so my wife and her friends tapped the button, and Uber showed up. Uber charged four times the going rate, surge pricing, and my wife was home within a half hour. And so it was a reminder right there that even if you take the Fed seriously, its interest rates are wholly backwards. The Fed, during periods of economic distress, pushes the rate that it targets down to zero. Well, why on earth would it do that? That's the equivalent of Uber, during mass demand for its drivers, setting the rate as low as possible. Well, if it did that, there wouldn't be drivers at Nat Stadium to take my wife and her friends home. The fact that they had surge pricing is what brought the drivers to the stadium.
Sure.
The Fed, in its infinite wisdom, does the exact opposite of what it should do. It tries to push the cost of credit down at a time when you want it to rise to a level that brings in savers who will be there for those who need credit.
Interesting. You know, I haven't heard anyone express that before, and maybe you haven't either, and that's why you thought of it. It's an interesting hypothesis because, you know, when we look at the supply and demand curve of anything in any market, and money is just another commodity, credit is just another commodity like gold, silver, concert tickets for Taylor Swift, one of my favorites, whatever, right? So you're right. It makes sense. But the way the Fed would seem to view it, John, is that they would say, well, we need to pump money into the economy. And since they don't really play by normal rules, they play by fiat. They can create money out of thin air and adjust the abundance of credit and money supply. Money supply and credit supply are kind of the same thing, but not exactly. By just lowering reserve ratios or creating money electronically out of thin air. We used to say printing, but they don't even print anymore. Printing is now too much of a burden, running a printing press. So it's not really the same, is it? Because they don't really play by the rules that Uber plays by, do they?
Ultimately, they do. The Fed can't change reality. The Fed cannot increase credit.
They can certainly distort it for a while.
My take is that the Fed's ability to distort much of anything is overstated. Let's never forget that when you borrow dollars, you're not borrowing dollars. My argument in the book is that money and credit are totally different. Mm-hmm. You're borrowing dollars for what they can be exchanged for. You're borrowing access to trucks, tractors, computers, desks, chairs, buildings, most important of all, labor. The Fed cannot increase what it is you're seeking when you seek credit. And so my take is, okay, assuming the Fed were to print trillions and trillions of dollars, It's not going to change the on-the-ground reality. Just because the Fed prints dollars doesn't mean that people are going to release their trucks and tractors to those who are in need of resources. And I would just add that the Fed can't pump money into the economy in the first place. Let's look at quantitative easing. The Fed tried to do that, and the reality is that tens of billions of dollars, quote, exited the United States on a monthly basis. Let's look at it on a local level. Let's say the Fed dropped $10 billion into the center of Baltimore. That money would exit Baltimore as quickly as it arrived, and it would because there's no economic growth taking place in Baltimore. Conversely, let's say the Fed drained all the banks in Silicon Valley of the money, if it raised the reserve requirements substantially. It would be utterly meaningless, simply because people around the world are lined up trying to have exposure to Silicon Valley. And so my take in the book is that we vastly overstate the Fed's importance. It's dealing with antiquated banks that are no longer major players in the credit space. And so, sure, I'd love to see it end, but even if it doesn't end, I think market forces are ending the Fed for us.
Well, listen, you're not going to get any argument from me in principle. I agree with you, and I like what you're saying. I do think, however, obviously the ivory tower theory and practice are two different things. And I'm not saying you're coming from the ivory tower, because I don't think you are. This is popular economics we're talking about, right? But look, I mean, there's no doubt that the Fed, by managing interest rates, massively influences markets. I mean, look at what's happened over the past several years coming out of the Great Recession in the housing market, in the stock market. I mean, the money is just flowing and, you know, it's finding places to go. I admit that there's a, you know, I like it more. Hang on, John, let me give you a little more to chew on. You argue with me all you want about it. No problem. But one more thing to chew on. I'd liken it more like to pumping oneself up with caffeine or going out and partying and having a hangover the next day. Of course, the crash is always present when you do that, but you definitely can stimulate for a little while, right? Okay, go ahead.
I really question that.
Okay,
I do, and I question it in the book. If quantitative easing is what powers markets forward, well, then let's explain Japan, because they've been conducting quantitative easing in Japan for 30 years now with no corresponding market rally.
I can explain that, by the way, if you want me to, but go ahead.
Well, why didn't it work in Japan, but it worked in the U.S.?
Yeah, my theory about Japan is Japan has a wholly different problem. Number one, of course, it doesn't work as well for anybody else because they don't have the reserve currency in the bully pulpit like the U.S. does. But that aside, Japan has a demographic problem. Japan is very insular. You know, there's really almost no immigration, okay? And they're not having any kids. And you can't build an economy on that. That's a country that's extinct.
Japan's economy,
go ahead.
Would you agree that this demographic problem is exponentially better than the one after World War II when the country was literally destroyed? That was a major demographic problem that the economy boomed.
Yeah, okay.
I think that it's so easy to make, I think it's more ivory tower to say that, well, we've got the printing press here. Markets respond to all this.
Sure, they do. Yeah, they adjust for it.
It's not as though investors are stupid.
Yeah, no, they're not.
So I hear, well, yeah, but see, the Fed kept interest rates low, and so there's a flight into yield. Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Funny how that didn't happen in Japan. And let's never forget that Japan is still a major economic force.
Oh, of course.
Oh, but see, the Fed created $4 trillion. It had to find itself somewhere. Well, it didn't. It borrowed $4 trillion from banks. But for a buyer excited by QE to enter the market, by definition, a seller must exit it. Mm-hmm. It's not as though implicit in this QE narrative that the Fed uniquely among all central banks had this ability to pump up stock market. It ignores all the times that the Fed couldn't pump up the stock market. But implicit there is that there are only buyers. No, there are sellers, too. Furthermore, markets price in the future. If, in fact, the Fed had been pumping up stock markets, logic dictates that when the Fed announced well before 2014 that it would eventually cease quantitative easing, that markets would react to it and sell off for good, except for they never did. I find the QE story so easy to discredit. I've presented my argument in front of the best investors in the world, including Cliff Asness at AQR, and I've never been questioned because it's not a very compelling argument when you think about it.
Well, I only think, you know, listen, I don't want you to get the impression I'm disagreeing with you, because in philosophically and in principle, I definitely agree with you. I'm just saying that people are creatures of instant gratification. You know, they know that it's a big game and it's a big sham, of course, you know, and so do other countries that hold our debt. They know it's, you know, they know we're destroying the value of our debt with inflation ultimately. But, you know, they play it in the small time horizon, right? They play these little,
and then if it's a small time horizon, it would show up in 30-year treasuries. I beg to differ. Doesn't make me an expert, but I've spent lots of time in China, and you talk to the government officials there, they point out that we're still not a rich country. Mm-hmm. We expect that money to be paid back. The idea that the rest of the world is in on some, hey, wink, wink, nod, nod, that, the treasuries are worthless, but we'll hold them, I don't find that compelling. I don't find it realistic. I'm not defending the debt. I'm not defending government spending. I'm a libertarian.
Yep.
But the idea that the rest of the world would sit there and just buy what is claimed to be worthless defies common sense. The reality is that the U.S. Treasury is backed by the most productive people on earth. We can talk about the Fed and all this other stuff and all these horrible things going on in the world, but the reality is the 10 most valuable companies in the world are based in the United States.
Right. Yeah. No question.
We attract more investment than any other country in the world. People risk their lives trying to get to this country.
Yeah.
Is it any wonder that the rest of the world wants to hold U.S. debt?
Yeah,
if we want to talk about the dollar and everything,
yeah, absolutely.
Different story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's not pretend that this is worthless.
No, you're absolutely right. The right question to ask is the one I always state. It's compared to what? You know, yes, the U.S. has all these things and all this monkey business, but, you know, compared to what? Everybody's playing this game, okay? Every country does this stuff, you know? Couldn't agree more. Okay, so on the Japan thing, though, post-World War II, I'm no expert on that, but my impression would be that, hey, number one, we were rebuilding Japan. Number two, we were moving into this baby boom time. Their exports, they were exporting all these cheap little products. Then the auto industry, the Japanese auto boom came along, and you know, it's complicated, but it's kind of...
I just think it's dangerous to say that was a much bigger demographic difficulty, and to pretend that, okay, so the way to fix a demographic problem is to go to war and have your country destroyed so you have to rebuild it. I don't think you believe that.
That's not a good idea.
Really,
I'm just saying it happened.
Okay, so that it happened did not improve Japan. Japan would be exponentially better off today, as would the U.S. have been, had we not been in that war in the first place. I really think it's dangerous to make an argument about, oh, yeah, well, the war saved Japan. Japan is a major, major economy. And implicit in the demographic argument is that somehow Japan's an island. No, Japan interacts with the rest of the world.
Of course they do.
Just as U.S. producers interact with the rest of the world. It would be an interesting argument if Japan didn't trade or import or export with anyone else, but that's just not true.
Yeah, of course. They're not isolated. I mean, they're just, in terms of their immigration policy and the birth rate, that's all. But, and I wasn't saying that war was good for Japan. War is never good.
The highest birth rates in the world are the poorest countries, and the countries with the lowest birth rates get the most investment.
Yeah.
And so I just think the demographic argument is, again, an exciting one that excites people who think that there are crises coming, but please,
yeah,
to spend time in Japan is not to spend time in a declining country. If that were true, you'd see a massive capital outflow. Markets aren't this stupid.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Good. Points well taken. I mean, you know, if I had Harry Dent on here, he'd be arguing with you, of course. You know the arguments, so you've heard them all.
Yes.
Okay. But listen, I want to switch gears. I want to just finish this topic, though, with... So during recessionary periods, it sounds like your thesis is that the Fed, the Fed should go away, but the marketplace should just raise interest rates, then more people would come in and want to loan money, and the lending of that money would act as a natural stimulus for the economy. Is that a proper analysis?
Oh, yeah, for the just
surge pricing on money.
Look,
we should have surge pricing on money.
Well, surge pricing on credit, you know, money is look, Mexico could lend the peso, but it wouldn't mean a whole lot. You know, the point is that credit is always going to find its level. And so the last thing you want to do is try to artificially lower the cost of it. Now, my book argues is look throughout the U.S. and we act as though the Fed doesn't exist. Credit is so expensive in Silicon Valley that if you want to start a business, you're going to give up a big portion of it to a venture capitalist, and then you're going to give even more of it up to potential employees in the form of stock options. Credit's so expensive in Hollywood that even the best movie producers are turned down well over 90% of the time. Donald Trump is our president. For decades after the early 90s, he couldn't get a loan from a U.S. bank to save his life. My point is that while the Fed's off in Neverland trying to set a zero rate and pretending, oh yeah, there's now easy credit, in the real economy, we thankfully act as though the Fed doesn't exist, because if the Fed did have control over us, we would be in perpetual decline, simply because who would lend at artificially low rates? And so in the real economy, rates are set by the markets. Thank goodness they are. If the Fed were a fraction of as powerful as we thought, as people thought it was, we'd be a very poor country.
Interesting. Okay. So the way the Fed looks at that equation, though, is they say we need to pump money in, so we need to artificially, admittedly, make rates lower, and that pumps the money in. You say, let the market decide, and if you want money, pay a surge price because you need it more, and there's less supply of it because people are reining in their horns, so you should pay more for credit, and then there will be more credit. I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, well, of course, and that is what's happening. Implicit is that when a recession hits, suddenly credit's easy. No, surge pricing takes place. The Fed's over here decreeing zero rates, but no one borrows for zero. I mean, Apple's the most valuable company in the world. It still pays 3% to borrow. Small businesses in a recession are still going to be shut out of the credit markets. The Fed is this entity dealing with banks that just aren't very big players in credit in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in the real world, credit costs what it costs. And mm-hmm. So the Fed pumping up the money supply, oh, please.
It's bogus.
Where can it pump up the money supply? If it tried to shrink it in Silicon Valley, market actors around the world would run roughshod over that within seconds.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
The same, the Fed could put billions into West Baltimore tomorrow, and that money would disappear instantaneously. Money flows to its highest use, so do resources. The notion that the Fed's a big player is defied by common sense. If it were, it could fix Baltimore tomorrow, yet Baltimore is still perpetually recessed. In Silicon Valley, well, banks aren't players in Silicon Valley in the first place, but the Fed can't change the on-the-ground reality in either place.
Right, right. Yeah. Dear listeners, we can tell our guest today is not a fan of Baltimore. Yeah, but I
No, I'm fully a fan. I just don't think that the Fed can't change it.
The Fed can't change
Cairo, Illinois. The Fed cannot change
Detroit.
Stockton, California.
Sure.
Can't.
Yeah.
In my book, I make the Detroit argument, too. Fed wants to drop billions into Detroit, it will disappear instantaneously because no business is going to expand based on a money drop.
Yeah.
Money always flows to its highest use. The Fed can't change it in a city, state, or country.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is why central planning doesn't work anywhere it's ever been tried. It really doesn't work. It only works around the margins, you know. It's and it's always temporary. Helicopter Ben, are you listening? So Ben Bernanke, of course, is who we're referring to. Let's switch it up and let's talk about robots and automation. Let me just kind of open this up if I can. I can't wait to hear what you say about this. So a few things. Number one, the U.S. Census has, you know, done all these studies over the years. And one of them is that the only job that disappeared in the last, like, I don't know, 100 years due to automation was only one job that disappeared, and that was elevator operator. We operate our own elevators nowadays. That career path is gone, and everything else is still with us, right? I just wonder, though, and the famous last words of any investor, John, if this time it's different. and why I say that is because the technology is startling now. It is, and I guess they probably thought that when the steam engine was invented too, maybe. But the transportation industry, arguably the biggest industry on earth, right, is transportation. Whether it be trucking, taxis, Ubers, Lyfts, UPS, mail, whatever it is, right? I mean, this is getting automated faster than fast. And all of these drivers, they're not, it is beautiful. I love it. And by the way, I have a theory about that. You know, a lot of our listeners are real estate investors. The biggest value driver for real estate since the beginning of time, since we were living on in caves, is location, location, location. Three biggest value drivers. I think that's going to be under pressure because I think location is going to be less meaningful than it's ever been in history. Still meaningful, just less meaningful. Interesting little side note. But, you know, these Lyft and Uber and taxi drivers and truck drivers are not going to become robotics engineers, are they? I mean, what are they going to do?
Well, they're not. But if we knew exactly what they were going to do, you and I would both be billionaires.
Of course.
But I would just make the point that you want to talk about the biggest industry in the history of mankind. It was food. If you were born 150 years ago, odds were substantial, even in the United States, that you knew exactly what you were going to do when you were able. You were going to work on a farm until you died.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first robot came along, or arguably the first. It was the backhoe followed by the tractor. Easily the biggest job destroyers in the history of mankind. But far from putting us into bread lines, no, they just freed us up to focus our energies on other things. We invented the car, airplane, computer. If it were about jobs, it would be simple. If we want to create jobs, let's just abolish the computer, the ATM machine, and Wi-Fi.
And join a union that wants to live in the dark ages and use clipboards.
And so everyone will be working and everyone will be incredibly poor. But if, you know, in Bangladesh, everyone's working.
Yeah, right.
It's just that they're miserable, but everyone's got a job in Bangladesh. And so technology is by definition about job destruction, and implicit there is that we're going to run out of things to fix. But as I look at the world, there's still so much to fix. We haven't fixed heart disease. We haven't fixed cancer. Furthermore, we're not nearly as entertained as we want to be. The reality is that all this automation is going to lead to a surge in new kinds of jobs simply because it's going to free us up. Used to be that we worked 6 days a week in the days before automation. Automation meant a 5-day work week. We're obviously headed toward a 4-day work week, if you believe my book. That means there's going to be a surge in the demand for entertainment. And so you see it in the NBA right now. They had a draft a little over a month ago for NBA 2K, not for basketball players, for video game players. Video game player is now a profession. So lucrative is that video game coach is now a profession.
Well, people there you go. That's a good point. That's a great point. Yeah.
People love to dine out.
Yeah.
You look back to the 1970s, chef wasn't even a professional qualification back then. If you told people you're going to get into cooking back then, they thought, what happened?
Yeah.
Kids were embarrassed back then if their parents worked in restaurants. Now they brag about it. Now becoming a chef is an alternative to becoming a doctor or a lawyer, and it's so specialized, it's so advanced, that there are now pastry chefs.
Yeah, right.
Just the other night, James Beard Award, they awarded the pastry chef of the year. And so there will always be jobs. Robots will certainly destroy jobs, and what they'll do is the result will be jobs that we go to work each day and that we're experts in.
Okay, so more specialization of labor, obviously, which is
you hit on something crucial, because what does specialization mean? When you can specialize, that means you can be an expert. And when you're an expert and specialized, you're much more productive.
Mm-hmm.
That's all free trade is just the acknowledgement that we're not good at everything. And so it frees us up to specialize in what we do best. Robots will take all the drudgery off of our plates and allow us to go to work each day and express our unique talents, our unique intelligence. I don't buy that anyone's stupid or lacks work ethic. But imagine if you and I had to work on a farm every day. I can say in my case, I would be very lazy and I'd be an object of pity. Thanks to automation, I don't have to do those things. Thanks to automation in the future, more and more people will get to do what they love for a job.
Okay. Yeah, very, very interesting. So it'll become more specialized. So thinking of it in terms of everything is going to be some kind of high-tech job as we become automated, the jobs left will be all these high-tech jobs, is just not accurate, because the truck drivers don't have to become robotics engineers. You're not going to need that many people. There will just be whole other areas created, and certainly we've seen that. I mean, the human imagination and amount of specialized labor, it's startling. We don't even know what we don't know, do we?
You say it so well, exactly. Implicit in this notion that we're going to run out of work is that we've basically exhausted the ability of people to innovate and achieve. And
or desire more stuff, not just innovate and achieve, just want more. The human want is just unlimited, right?
Yeah, were you and I demanding Uber 10 years ago?
No.
I wasn't. Yeah. I would have liked it. Were we demanding the internet in 1990? No. And so what's important about this is that in Silicon Valley, it's not just that there are tech workers. You hit it on the head. It's not just that those are the jobs being created. Thanks to all that innovation out there, there are countless yoga instructors being employed, countless doctors, lawyers, countless baristas, countless sommeliers, countless chefs. Right now in Silicon Valley, there is a war on among companies to lure the best chefs to these different companies, these different booming companies. And so the jobs that will be created as a result of this are going to be endless. Right now, there are countless people who earn a living just based on posting their shopping habits online.
Mm-hmm.
That is now a business. Influencer is now a job. Mm-hmm. People who love football, you're in for an amazing future. When Bill Belichick got into coaching, the average NFL assistant was paid $25 a week. Nowadays, my goodness, assistants earn the millions of dollars a year. Boise State has a $2 million annual budget for assistant coaches alone. In the state of Georgia alone, there are 23 high school football coaches who earn over $100,000 a year. This is high school.
Wow, amazing.
This is the world we're evolving into. If you have a hobby, if you love something, there is a career for it. Video games, football, shopping, you name it. 30 years ago, if you said you were going to get into be a small sommelier, people would have laughed at you. Well, now it's a growing business. And so with the automation, the demand for entertainment, the demand for dining at all levels, the demand for all sorts of services is going to explode.
Yeah, no question. Yeah, and it's truly amazing. I mean, you know, entertainment demand is stunning. You know, it's interesting, though, there were predictions in the early 70s that we would only work 3 days a week in the future by the year 2000, and that the computers and the robots and all the technology coming was just going to make our lives easy, and we weren't going to have to do anything. People will just sit there and be the masters of the machines, if you will. That certainly didn't happen. You did say just now we're going to have a 4-day work week. So what do you think?
I'll say this time is different.
Yeah, 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 right. Yeah, the famous last words of any investor, right?
Yeah. No, fair enough. What I would say is that the 1970s predictions were simply early,
mm-hmm.
but it strikes me we're getting closer and closer to it. And if the robots fulfill their promise, it's inevitable that people will be able to get done in 3 and 4 days what it used to take 5. I mean, mm-hmm. there was a time when the average person worked 6 days a week. Now, what's interesting to me about this is I think I describe you and saying and how I describe me. I love what I do uncontrollably.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing for me to work on weekends.
Right.
And so where I see this happening is I think people will have more and more have the option to work less, and there will be more and more 4-day-a-week office jobs. But I also think as a result of all this prosperity, what I describe in the book, Tammany's Law, that as prosperity grows, more and more people escape laziness because they find work they love. I think we're going to see a scenario whereby people are working really long hours just because their work is how they express their unique intelligence.
Yeah, very good point.
Work is their joy.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't true in past generations. My dad would have loved to have been a basketball coach. That's
uh-huh.
really what he
uh-huh.
wanted, but he had a wife and 2 kids. It wasn't the responsible thing. Nowadays, it's fully normal to do that, and it's remunerative. If that's your passion, you can be in basketball all of your life, and you can have a very nice life for being in basketball. So different, and it's going to get better and better. Work will be about going. People will race to work because that's where they're experts.
Yeah, right. That's where they get the recognition. That's where they get the fulfillment. That's a great thought. I certainly hope that happens. And it does seem, I mean, certainly the technology has made the boundary between work and play. It's made it very non-existent. But, you know, they have a lot more choice now, that the work isn't drudgery. It shouldn't be drudgery. It should be good. One last thing I want to ask you about, and I'd be interesting, you know, it's interesting. A lot of my libertarian friends, oddly, are in favor of UBI, Universal Basic Income, which to me, at least at first blanch, seems like another welfare program, right? I'd be really curious to see what you think of it. I don't know. You might be kind of counterintuitive. I would assume you're against it, but...
I'm very much against it. No doubt you're familiar with public choice theory. Can you imagine handing politicians the right to run on who is going to raise our UBI
vote? Yeah, right.
The immorality on its face of people being able to vote themselves raises on the backs of others. I think it's a work disincentive, but I would argue that that's probably overrated. My guess as in talking to you is you love what you do. I love what I do. No basic income could stop me from working. And so I don't think that it means everyone would just sit on their hands and wait for a meager income. But I just think it's dangerous. I don't like the idea of people being able to vote themselves income. That is very, very problematic to me. And so, no, I would be very much against the institution of something like that.
Yeah. Okay, good. Good stuff. Interesting discussion for sure. John, give out your website and tell people where they can find the books and so forth.
The website is www.realclearmarkets.com. And then the new book is The End of Work. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can find all my books on there. They're all very optimistic assessments of the future.
Fantastic. John Tamney, thank you so much for joining today. Very interesting discussion. Appreciate having you on.
Thank you for having me on, Jason.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.